Okay, can everybody hear me okay? I think the microphone's working. Well, thanks a lot, Professor Chinkin. It is, as you say, we've known each other for a long time, but haven't had so many opportunities, actually, to sit side by side on a panel like this. So it's terrific, and I'm very happy to have my first chance also of visiting here at the new Centre for Women, Peace and Security. It's a great development, and we're following with much interest what the Centre is doing. Obviously, also very happy to have this opportunity to share with all of you some of the work that we've been doing over the past 20 years at the ICTY when it comes to prosecuting conflict-related sexual violence. So in my address today, what I'm going to do is start off by explaining a little bit about the legacy project that ultimately led to the publication of the book that we are launching here today. And then I'm going to give you some glimpses, at least in the time available, into some of the key insights that we've distilled in this book, which has really been done with a view to what we hope will be useful for prosecutors in the future as they take forward our work. But before I start, I wanted to just begin by showing, in a few minutes, the testimonies of some of the sexual violence victims who appeared in ICTY proceedings over the past 20 years. I think it is really important that we remember the courage, the experiences, a very compelling reminder of why it is so important that we have occasions like today where those of us involved in the process have a chance to reflect and really recommit to improving the accountability process in the future. So Zoe, I'm hoping that we can show the video now.
And what was the condition of this room to which you were taken?
It was all covered with blood.
What happened to you in this room?
Željko Borana, who had worked in Kripo, came in with two soldiers with camouflage uniforms and with masks on their faces. You could not see who they were, and then I was raped again.
When you were raped, were you also beaten?
Yes.
Mrs. Ramich, at this time, after the things that had occurred to you over the last few days, what was your emotional and mental state?
Horrible. Very, very bad.
I, like all the other girls in Karaman's house, was raped by the Serb soldiers. I think that after a certain amount of time, that two other girls were brought in, or three, but at any rate, all of them were raped, either every night or every other night. Often.
Are you able to count how many times you were raped in Karaman's house?
I don't think that is possible.
Zenga took this piece of slow-burning fuse roughly this long, and then he... I apologize. Can I use my own words?
Use your own words, certainly.
He wound it round my anus. He put one end inside and the other round my penis, and then there was a piece sticking out here, and then he lit it. I have a scar there from this fuse. And he did this in front of all the prisoners in the hangar, in the middle of the hangar, near the door. All the prisoners could see what Zenga was doing to me, how he set light to this fuse.
And what happened in the room?
Well, as usual, rape. In their own way. It wasn't sex with pleasure. It was with fury. They were taking it out on us.
While this occurred, have you ever been beaten?
In Partizan, yes, one of them. I don't remember the date. He slapped me, and he asked me, should he slaughter my daughter? I was quiet, then he slapped me. When he left, he turned around towards all of us in the doorway, and he said he'd come back and kill us all. Fortunately, he never appeared again.
And it was difficult for me. I was a woman who only lived for one man, and I was his all my life. And I think that I was just getting separated from my body at this time. After that, he told me not to say this to anyone, and soon the candle went out, and I got up. And then another man came after that. I did not see that one, and he raped me too. And then after that, I remained by myself, and I cried. And then I said how to go back to my husband and my children and my family, because this is very difficult. But it is a force that is beyond me.
As a result of all the rapes that you suffered during these many months, did you continue to suffer?
In a way, yes. I think that I'm once again at a point where I find it difficult to explain. I think that I have decided to try and leave many of those things behind me somewhere. Although within me, I still have, and there will always be, traces of everything that happened to me. I think that for the whole of my life, all my life, I will have thoughts of that and feel the pain that I felt then and still feel. That will never go away.
So, ladies and gentlemen, back in 1994, when the ICTY Office of the Prosecutor first set out on its work, as the first truly international war crimes tribunal in history, there were, of course, many, many formidable challenges facing the office. In the midst of an ongoing conflict still in Bosnia, there were questions about how we could commence, let alone successfully complete, our investigations. With no police force, how were we to ever arrest and bring into custody the accused persons we're indicting? And with our limited resources, how could we hope to really collect evidence from traumatized victims from the Balkan conflicts who were scattered all over the globe? But even amid this cocktail of other pressing demands, another challenge had been laid down for us by the international community. And, I must add, an increasingly vocal civil society determined to finally end centuries of inaction. And that, of course, was how could the office establish accountability for conflict-related sexual violence crimes committed during the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia? In the two decades that followed, I think those of us involved in the process would have to agree that this has presented one of the key tests for the office in the completion of its mandate. For sure, there have been many successes over the years, but there have also been missteps and lessons learned as we attempted to forge a new accountability path for this category of crimes. So with this in mind, and as the end of the ICTY's work was approaching, we realised that we had a unique opportunity to reflect on, to reconstruct, and to record ultimately on paper what had previously been only in the minds and the memories of the people who were working on these cases over so many years, the investigators, the interpreters, the prosecutors and others. So in 2009, we first conceptualised our OTP legacy project on conflict-related sexual violence crimes. And in the absence of any dedicated resources for this project, we called for volunteers across the office who would be willing to take on this project in addition to their core case-related work. The response was really overwhelming. As an office, we seemed to collectively understand that we did have this unique opportunity and fleeting opportunity to potentially record something valuable for the future. From the beginning, we were quite clear, at least, about the objectives of the project. So we wanted it to be an honest reflection, not a sanitized record of our achievements. We wanted it to be an insider perspective, written by practitioners for practitioners. We wanted it to be a practical resource for the future, not just an historical record of our past work. And most importantly, we wanted it to be a final step in repaying the courage displayed by the victims who testified in our proceedings over many years, some of whom you've just heard today. Testifying often involved reliving trauma and took a personal toll on the victims. But despite this, over and over again, they expressed to us their desire to contribute to a future where accountability for conflict-related sexual violence was the norm. A future where no one would have to go through what they had been through. So this sentiment, as you can imagine, left a profound impact on those of us in the office. We really felt that if the victims of sexual violence could display such courage, then surely we as an office could find a way to maximise the impact of our work through an honest and open reflection on what we had learned, and hopefully then triggering a deeper and more sophisticated dialogue about where we should go from here. So we had the best possible incentive to persevere with our legacy project, which in fact took us ultimately over 6 years to complete. We scoured the OTP's voluminous documentary collections, and must be said, unwieldy documentary collections, so this in and of itself was quite a task, so that we could pull together a comprehensive archive of our internal documentation on conflict-related sexual violence cases. We interviewed past and present staff members, and with financial support from UN Women, we brought back as a consultant for a period of time Patty Sellers, who of course was the legal advisor for gender issues in the office from an early stage. We conducted missions to the former Yugoslavia to speak with various stakeholders there about the challenges being faced domestically in prosecuting conflict-related sexual violence. And we workshopped a preliminary draft of the manuscript with four external experts, Patty, of course, Susanna Sakuto, Kirsten Campbell, and Gorana Mlinarevic, who helped us really dig much deeper into the fundamental insights that might be useful for others in the future. We started out speaking about our legacy paper, but at the point where it had reached more than 500 pages, we realised that paper might be understating it a bit, and that we really had a book that could be published. And with this realisation, we started thinking about practical things like what would we put on the front cover? Here too, we saw an opportunity to spark deeper reflection and dialogue. And so we ran a competition in universities in the former Yugoslavia to produce artworks depicting the concept of justice in the context of conflict-related sexual violence. The winning entry, which you see pictured on the front of the book, was produced by a young art student then at the International University in Sarajevo, Amanda Bisic. And her beautiful image, when submitted to our competition, was entitled Invisible Since 1995. As a 25-year-old living in Sarajevo, her overwhelming impression of this issue was of dramatically fading attention for the victims of sexual violence as time went on, and ultimately invisibility. It's a powerful message and one not easily forgotten. So we have produced this book, Prosecuting Conflict-Related Sexual Violence at the ICTY. It was a difficult book to write in many, many ways. And we could have relatively easily pulled together a descriptive account of our legal framework at the ICTY for prosecuting these crimes. We could have pulled together a summary of the charges that we prosecuted and the judgments that resulted. But to really drill down into our operational experience inside our office about the challenge of accountability for these crimes required much deeper and more difficult reflection. So we contemplated some fundamental questions, which we've attempted, at least, to answer in the book. We asked, why is this category of crimes so challenging for practitioners? What are the institutional and legal strategies that can help a prosecution office secure better accountability outcomes? How do we see those reflected in our work, and where could we have used them better? We hear a lot about the need for a victim-centred approach in criminal proceedings, but really concretely, what does this mean? How do we see it reflected in the examples from our own practice, or where do we see scope for having adopted better practices to bringing evidence forward in our cases? How should we approach sentencing in sexual violence cases? How do we reflect the reality of the harm done to the victims without reinforcing damaging stigma and other discriminatory paradigms? What gaps do we see in our judgments on sexual violence crimes at the ICTY, and what might account for those gaps? And finally, we know that increasingly accountability for international crimes will depend on justice at the national level. How can our work now inform what's being done in national prosecutions around the globe? Ultimately, we saw that although obviously having an adequate legal framework for sexual violence crimes is important, the success of the accountability process depends crucially on an array of human factors. It depends critically on the way that we as human beings think about sexual violence, the way we conceptualise these crimes, our comfort levels in talking about them, the priority that we give to addressing them, our understanding of the gender factors behind them, and our level of commitment to meeting the challenges inevitably involved in investigating and prosecuting them. So reflecting on all of this in preparation for today, I began to think about what my handover note would be to future prosecutors about the challenge of accountability for conflict-related sexual violence crimes. What would I say to colleagues in the future, based on my 15 years of experience at ICTY, as well as the experience I had overseeing this legacy project? As background, I should mention that handover notes are somewhat in vogue at ICTY these days, given the inevitable staff turnover that accompanies a downsizing institution, and also as a result of the gradual transition of ICTY's functions to its residual body, the Mechanism for International Criminal Tribunals, or the MICT, as we like to call it. The actual handover note on prosecuting conflict-related sexual violence crimes would, of course, in true lawyerly form, be at least 50 pages long, and in keeping with UN practice, it would be available in English and French. But today, in outlining my note, I'm going to spare you both the length and my French. So, to future prosecutors, as you take up your important work in establishing accountability for conflict-related atrocities, you will be challenged by the magnitude of your responsibilities and the weight of the day-to-day demands on you and your colleagues. But at the same time, you must be committed to ensuring justice for all victims of conflict, males and females alike. As a start towards this process, here are five things to remember when it comes to your work on conflict-related sexual violence crimes. First of all, do not assume that the historical silences surrounding conflict-related sexual violence have now been permanently corrected. For sure, the past few years have seen unprecedented attention to this issue. In addition to the work of the ad hoc and hybrid tribunals, the International Criminal Court, the United Nations Security Council, as Christine mentioned, has mandated the appointment of a special representative to the Secretary General on sexual violence in conflict, and receives annual reports on the status of conflict-related sexual violence worldwide. The United Kingdom's Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflict initiative, unveiled by former Foreign Secretary William Hague, placed accountability for these crimes on the political agenda for the first time. But do not assume that these developments have irrevocably changed the way we address conflict-related sexual violence. We've seen from our own experience how quickly the attention can fade and how easily the gains can be lost. We have to remember that back in 1993, when the ICTY was set up, the world was also then preoccupied with the idea of bringing perpetrators to justice. The shock and outrage accompanying widespread reporting about the use of rape as a weapon of war sparked determined calls for justice. Deliberate steps were taken to make sure the ICTY had a legal and procedural framework that could respond to these crimes. But in 1994, as our office began its operations, it was not a given that this international attention would translate into concrete results in our cases. There were, it seemed, a multitude of reasons to explain why accountability was just too difficult. We can't find any evidence of sexual violence. The victims won't come forward to testify. It's too time and resource intensive to investigate and prosecute sexual violence. We don't have enough female investigators and interpreters to deal with these crimes. We have other more serious crimes to prioritise with our limited resources. We also found that the risk of complacency became significant after some initial successes. At the ICTY, the Kunerats case dealing with sexual slavery in the Foča municipality in Bosnia and Herzegovina was widely hailed as a landmark first international prosecution focusing exclusively on sexual violence crimes. But as the prison doors closed on the three accused in that case, the world's attention turned elsewhere and the scrutiny of our work on sexual violence subsided. We also saw how easily the progressive developments in our jurisprudence on conflict-related sexual violence could slide backwards over time. Early on, we celebrated precedents confirming the classification of sexual violence as torture, as enslavement, as crimes against humanity, persecution, and even genocide. And we had common sense, if not always theoretically impeccable, approaches to defining rape. But years later, in our Kosovo cases, we were confounded by court rulings inexplicably imposing higher evidentiary standards for sexual violence crimes, different standards for the foreseeability, proving the foreseeability of sexual violence, and for proving the discriminatory intent behind it than required for other categories of crimes. This left us scrambling to try and reverse these damaging precedents on appeal, fortunately with some success. So the lesson in all of this, future prosecutors, no matter how strong the rhetorical and policy commitments are to accountability for conflict-related sexual violence crimes, you will continue to face operational and human challenges. But you must not see these as excuses for inaction. They should rather be an incentive for even more resourcefulness in finding institutional and legal strategies to counter them. And you will have to be permanently vigilant in making sure poor practices don't creep back in over time. Fundamentally, your challenge is to continue the process we've started of truly situating accountability for sexual violence as part of core prosecution work. We've made important progress, but we're not there yet. The second thing is to think more about the process of de-linking sexual violence from the concept of sex. As we trace back over our two decades of work, so many problems that we encountered are directly connected to the fact that we continue to identify rape and other similar acts more closely with sex, albeit non-consensual, than with violent physical assaults. This is reflected, for example, in the historical tendency to see rape as diminishing a victim's honour. The crippling social stigma that so frequently accompanies rape, even when committed by opposing enemy forces in the middle of an armed conflict. Our ongoing tendency to see rape as less serious than other violent crimes. Our vulnerability to missing the connections between rape and other violent crimes. And our tendency to assume that rape is motivated by personal factors such as sexual desire and not by other factors connected to the conflict. We saw these misconceptions play out not only in our own office, but also in some of the judgments rendered by the court. prosecutors of the future, you will undoubtedly encounter many of these same misconceptions in your work, and they will be a problem for you. If you see rape as more a matter of honour than a violent crime, you will underestimate its seriousness and underprioritise your scarce resources in addressing it. If you see rape as an incidental and personally motivated act, you will have difficulty conceptualising how to charge it as a crime against humanity or genocide. And you will have even more difficulty conceptualising how to link it to senior political and military officials to hold them accountable in appropriate cases. But perhaps most fundamentally, our preoccupation with rape as a sexual matter perpetuates our fundamental inability to talk about this category of crimes even today. And if we're still uncomfortable even talking about what has happened to the victim, we cannot hope to fundamentally improve the accountability process. These are big issues, and as prosecutors, you cannot hope to solve them alone. We need, obviously, a combined approach, also involving political and religious leaders, policymakers, and civil society. But as prosecutors, there are some things that you can do to contribute to the process of breaking down the crippling stigma and misconceptions that exacerbate the harm to the victim. You can take every opportunity in presenting your cases to emphasise the violent and serious nature of rape. You can think hard about the most effective legal and evidentiary strategies for demonstrating the link between rape and other violent crimes. You can adopt an approach in sentencing that acknowledges the gravity of the social harm inflicted on the victims, but at the same time doesn't reinforce the notion that a victim's honour has in fact been diminished by the crime suffered. And you can commit to appealing negative court judgments that impose higher evidentiary burdens in sexual violence cases just because of its perceived sexual nature. Future prosecutors, the third point is a warning about the strategic sexual violence trap. No doubt, as you start your work, your frame of reference for sexual violence crimes will be heavily informed by the media reporting, human rights fact-finding, and general international dialogue that has characterised the sexual violence in the conflict in question. And if it's similar to our experience, that characterisation will likely link the gravity of sexual violence to its perceived strategic use. Rape as a weapon of war, rape pursuant to orders, mass rape as part of a systematic pattern. And certainly your job as prosecutors is to understand the way that sexual violence has occurred in any given context and to use the most appropriate legal and evidentiary strategies to accurately reflect that in your cases. Consistent with some of the earlier media reporting from the Balkan conflicts, in ICTY cases, we have indeed been able to establish that sexual violence was used as part of an integral part of the methodology for ethnic cleansing. But we have found it's a trap to overly focus on the strategic use of sexual violence or to make prosecutorial action conditional on meeting that threshold. Sometimes sexual violence may rather be part of a tolerated practice, and sometimes it may occur opportunistically. But it is always serious and always deserves due attention. Related to this, don't be misled into thinking that sexual violence has to happen on a large scale to be prosecuted. Even as a crime against humanity or genocide, sexual violence occurring in low numbers can be prosecuted as long as the crimes can be linked to a widespread and systematic attack or were animated by genocidal intent. We've learned over time that rather than focusing too narrowly on the strategic aspect of sexual violence, we're better off focusing on contextualising sexual violence in our cases. By this we mean presenting evidence of sexual violence in the broader factual context in which it occurs, maximising our chances of accurately characterising it and appropriately addressing it no matter what form it takes. The fourth point is to emphasise the importance of developing professional networks among practitioners working on conflict-related sexual violence crimes globally. In 1993, as the OTP started out on its challenge of accountability for sexual violence in the Balkans, it was virtually alone in its task. But over the years, we saw other international prosecution officers established: the Rwanda Tribunal, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the International Criminal Court. They all went through a similar process to us and experienced many of the same challenges, missteps, and setbacks that we did. And increasingly today, we see prosecution officers at the national level grappling with the same accountability challenge. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, for example, we've watched closely as our national prosecution counterparts have taken over responsibility for the hundreds of war crimes cases that remain pending, including involving sexual violence charges. They're confronted with many of the same challenges, obstacles, and pressure points that we've identified in our book and in our work more generally. It's a story currently echoed in many national jurisdictions around the world, from Colombia and the DRC to Rwanda and the Central African Republic. And while informally, at least, there have been some expertise and personnel exchanges, we could have benefited from a more formal or structured mechanism for connecting prosecutors across diverse jurisdictions. So with that in mind, last year, we established the Prosecuting Conflict-Related Sexual Violence, or PSV, network through the International Association of Prosecutors. Supported by the Office of the Prosecutor of both the ICTY and the MICT, our mission with this network is to avoid the problem of new prosecution officers starting from scratch when they commence their mandate, and instead ensure each new process can build on our growing global wisdom about prosecuting these crimes. So prosecutors of the future, we hope that you will see the value in engaging with professional networks that can help you access information and expertise and help you identify solutions to the challenges that you will confront in your work. And specifically, of course, we hope you will become members of the IOP PSV network. The fifth and final point in my handover note, at least for today, is the importance of understanding the gender dimension of sexual violence and of international criminal law more broadly. Future prosecutors, you will hear phrases like sexual and gender-based crimes, or SGBC, repeated often. But your challenge will be to cut beneath the sometimes mantra-like repetition to ensure that you really understand what gender means and why it is so crucial for international justice practitioners to take account of gender factors in constructing the complex cases they deal with under international criminal law. So let's start with sexual violence crimes specifically. We know that males and females can be victims of sexual violence crimes. And we also know that males and females can be perpetrators. But do not make the mistake of assuming that sexual violence is a gender-neutral crime. Gender, the socially constructed roles of males and females in a given society, can affect the form sexual violence takes, the reasons underpinning it, the harm, including the social harm experienced by the victim as a result of the crimes, and our reactions as international justice practitioners to these crimes. And future prosecutors, when it comes to international criminal law more generally, and particularly your work in addressing atrocities targeting whole communities, be aware that these crimes will often target the gendered foundations on which the community is constructed. Our Srebrenica cases at the ICTY dramatically illustrate this point. As the Bosnian Serb forces advanced on Srebrenica in July 1995, the so-called military-aged men were separated from the women, children, and elderly. Thousands of men were executed in just a few days. Up to 30,000 women, children, and elderly persons were expelled from the Srebrenica enclave. Confronted with overwhelming crimes and limited resources, our office initially considered prosecuting only the killings to the exclusion of the expulsions. Unfortunately, we reversed that decision. Otherwise, we would have not only failed to address crimes against thousands of victims, but we would have missed the complete picture of genocide in Srebrenica. As the ICTY Appeals Chamber ultimately found, the killings, in combination with the expulsions, showed the intent to destroy the Bosnian Muslim community in Srebrenica. Future prosecutors, your challenge will be to use our growing gender competence when it comes to sexual violence crimes to inform your approach to international criminal law more generally. We now need to extend our gender analysis to more fully understand the distinctive impact of armed conflict on males and females and the gender variables in all of the crimes committed against them. That concludes my address. I'm very happy to have some time for questions.
Thank you, Michelle, for that illuminating, very practical, operational, but also very human, and keeping in mind the horrific nature of the crimes that we are talking about. We started about 10 minutes late, so I think we can certainly afford to go on to about 25 past. So, who would like to start with questions? And perhaps we have roving mics, and if you could just say who you are first and keep questions, you know, to the point and be brief.
My name's Emily Winborn. I was a prosecutor in Australia for many years, and I'm now at Leiden studying international law. I wanted to know how you think we can best combat ignorance and misunderstanding of gender within particularly the judicial levels of the courts.
We'll get two or three.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think about it. Have you got a pen, paper?
I don't, actually. I'm not a pen, but...
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I've got somebody hidden behind the lectern as well.
It's Lisa. I'll pass it after.
Karen.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm from Women for Women International. Thank you so much for such a wonderful start to the day, and I think showing the videos first was sets an excellent context. My question was around, when you were talking about the cover of the book, you talked about the invisibility of the survivors. And I just wondered if you think, in terms of the challenges and the learnings, if a more integrated national process might have helped raise the profile in country or kind of stimulated those discussions rather than an international process, mm-hmm. something more hybrid, I guess, is my question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also thanks again, that was really wonderful introduction. I wondered if you'd had any reflections on peacetime, prosecuting peacetime rape or engagement with people who are prosecuting peacetime rape and whether there are lessons learned from understandings of conflict-related rape that are applicable in peacetime.
Okay. If we take those three mm-hmm. and then sort
sure.
of have another. Yeah. So thank you.
Okay.
So three challenging questions.
Yeah, absolutely. One of them, fortunately, directs attention to our judicial colleagues, so I can. But I'm happy to talk about that. But perhaps I'll start with Lisa's question, the third one, about prosecuting rape in peacetime. In fact, in the last chapter of the book, what we do is situate our experience in the OTP in what we saw as the broader global context on this issue, which had really emerged in the two decades since we started our work. And indeed, we saw a number of connections between what we've been doing and work now being done by others. And the lessons that might be useful from our work for national prosecutors, certainly prosecuting conflict-related sexual violence, but also prosecuting violence and sexual violence in general, is something that we flag in the book. For example, I've always thought it was really interesting that the misconceptions that we have encountered in our work are so different from the discriminatory paradigms that national prosecutors face with rape cases in general. I'm reluctant to call it peacetime rape, but you know what I mean. It's non-conflict related rape. In that, you know, you all know that historically one of the difficulties has been these assumptions, misconceptions that rape complainants are inherently untrustworthy and prone to fabrication because this involves a matter of their sexual integrity. At the ICTY, of course, we didn't encounter that. For our fact finders, it was, of course, not difficult to understand that when confronted with some of the voices you heard, you know, a woman raped in a detention setting where she's been held by members of the opposing armed force, subjected to a whole range of mistreatment, that, of course, the sexual violence was, non-consensual. So those issues didn't come up in the same way in our work. But I think there is a lesson there in that the reason why they don't come up is because we're presenting evidence of rape in context, in the context of a conflict. We're always having to link it to a conflict for the purposes of a war crime, to link it to a widespread systematic attack for a crime against humanity, to show that it was part of a process of destroying a group for the purpose of genocide. So we're never just isolating an act of rape and prosecuting it on its own. You think about how it works in national systems, very often that's precisely what prosecutors are having to do. And of course the contextual factors in peacetime are different, but nevertheless rape does occur in the context of a broader discriminatory system where gender discrimination is a massive problem. So I wonder whether there isn't a dialogue to be had among international prosecutors and national prosecutors around some of these issues, where we've seen differences, where might the strategies be? Are there ways of approaching national prosecutions that might build on some of the work that we've done? Working backwards in terms of the order of the questions, the question about the invisibility. Look, obviously the fact that we were an international court located in The Hague had implications for our ability to communicate with the affected population. And I think we have seen other models like the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which are located in country, indeed have advantages in terms of the accessibility of the work of the court with the population. So I think that is a given. And obviously in moving forward, the hybrid model is increasingly being adopted rather than a purely international model. But there are, of course, some advantages to the model that we had as well. Of course, people thought at the time it really was the only one available to situate a court in the midst of Bosnia as an ongoing conflict was occurring was obviously going to be extremely difficult. But one thing we have learned for sure is the importance of outreach. And we did not initially start with an outreach program at ICTY. It was something that came later, as we realised indeed that we were having this problem of communication with the affected communities. And I think it's also for people coming from justice backgrounds in national systems where the criminal process operates, everybody knows what their role is and that's what they do. I mean, it's very different when you are being set up as an accountability process that is somehow intended to feed into reconciliation or peace and security type objectives. So again, I think it was a gradual realisation of, well, it's not going to automatically happen by rendering judgments in The Hague. We're going to have to be out there among the affected communities, talking about the work, making it understandable, accessible to people across the region. So we have indeed done a number of different things. Our outreach unit, I think, also has some pretty fantastic lessons learned and insights for the future. And there have been a lot of workshops around particular crime zones, crime bases as we call it, including, for example, the Focha case, which was, of course, our thematic rape prosecution. I think that is a really important point. These are competing objectives, but whichever model is chosen, it's absolutely crucial to think strategically about how to communicate with the affected population and make the work meaningful. More recently, we've certainly realised the opportunity to reach out to the new generation, you know, to really make sure that we've gone out into the universities, increasingly even the high schools, to talk about the work that we've done and try and just establish a factual record on that. So we continue to do that. But the art competition that we ran, I think, is really the first time we've had a specific outreach project on sexual violence crimes in this way. So I think for us as well, it's been a very positive development. We were pleasantly surprised by the number of entries that we got. We weren't sure how university students would respond to this challenge. We just advertised it and waited to see what would happen. But we've got about 40 entries, and really the level of thought and consideration, particularly in this winning entry, is really encouraging.
What have you done with the other entries?
They are. In fact, for the launch in The Hague, we had a little exhibition of the top, Lada, I think it was 15 entries that we had. We mounted them all and people could look at them. And, the messages were really diverse. The ideas behind them were incredible. So to get a glimpse into what this new generation is thinking on a topic like this was great. We do also have some posters, which unfortunately we didn't bring today, but perhaps we should have. You could have got an idea about the diversity behind them. But I think we will continue to use the artworks in the outreach more generally that we're doing at ICTY. And then the question about the judiciary. You know, in the book, I mean, we come up across this all the time, and interestingly, it is a question that is always asked when we speak about the book, and we don't focus really on the judges in here, except now and then as we're integrating a sort of follow-through on a message, and we're talking about the need to be able to convey that message to the bench. I mean, we really wanted to focus on our record as an OTP and not to start weighing in on what other people had done or should have done. But obviously a lot of the messages in here are relevant for judges and I think do provide a good basis for judicial training in the future. It is a challenge, but we did, I mean, especially the misconceptions, we did see the same problems that we confronted in our office playing out in the judgments at the end of the day. So it's a reality, and we need commitment on the level of our judges to really focusing in on this. I do think that the pressure from civil society early on was also felt by the judges at ICTY and that they were very conscious of the need to think carefully about what they were saying on things like definitions of rape, rape as torture and those other crimes. We were assisted by, of course, amicus curiae briefs, and I think you were involved in one of them early on. And so all of that, I think, helped the judges to understand that the world was watching to a degree and that they really needed to think progressively about these issues. And we did indeed get some progressive jurisprudence, particularly early on. But I think ultimately the message in our book on this is, as prosecutors, we don't have control over what the judges think. We're dealing with panels of judges in international courts that are very diverse, being drawn from civil law systems, common law systems, various nationalities, listening to our submissions through interpretation. So it's really challenging. But we could definitely see, looking back, more scope for us to really lay it out for them in our legal arguments around conflict-related sexual violence. And that's, in the end, what we had to do when we were challenging some of the problematic trial precedents that we got on appeal, when we really had to think, OK, how do we explain to a judge in the appeals chamber why it is just nonsensical to say that in the midst of a violent ethnic campaign that killings, beatings, property damage is all foreseeable, that somehow rape is not? So I think, yeah, for us, the message is, yeah, I mean, obviously training of judges is important. We want our judicial colleagues to take it seriously, but we need to also step up and make sure that we give them every reason to come to the correct decision.
A couple more very quick, yeah. I'll take those two and sort of very quickly, yeah, and then we'll move on to the first panel.
Hi, I'm Joanne Neenan. I'm a legal advisor at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And thank you so much. That was really, truly compelling. I was really interested in what you said about emphasising the violent nature of the crime rather than overly emphasising the sexual nature and how this, I think implicitly you said, how this may help sort of debunk and destroy societal norms and notions of, that this is relating to honour and desire, etc. But I wonder whether there was any dialogue with the victims, because in the context of their sort of society, they may very much feel that their honour has been offended. So I wondered how you sort of dealt with that, because I can see that there may be a slight tension between trying to be progressive and actually have an impact on these false concepts, but then the victim in the context of their life may feel their honour has been offended. So if that aspect wasn't addressed, that may potentially have ramifications on how they feel and how society receives them and when they return. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah Maniadis. I don't have any legal training, so forgive me, but I may represent maybe the layperson out on the street in my perspective on these issues. I sort of had two questions. One was around, you were talking about, it kind of follows on from your question, so focusing on whether it does, you know, social harm to the victim's reputation versus the violent nature of the crime. But I was wondering if there's an avenue to prosecute on psychological grounds as well, as in, you know, someone was being tortured and locked in a room and threatened with torture, that would be psychological abuse. So, yeah, whether there's an element of rape that can be prosecuted against on psychological grounds. And my other question was, forgive me, sorry. Yes, sorry, I apologise. We can just leave it at that. If
we can
that
stay
works.
After if you like.
Okay, yes, yeah. And the break.
This will be a whole day. So.
Exactly. Right.
And I'm confident we'll go into many of these themes more in depth in the following panels. We have a number of authors from the book here, so you can drill down into some of the difficulties with them as well.
Is that a very quick one?
Yes.
Very. Well, again, I suspect many of the answers are going to be coming out all day.
Yeah. I'm Raquel Vázquez from Eyewitness International Bar Association. My question is around if you could elaborate more around the evidence used by ICTY in these kind of crimes, but mostly, I mean, I know you relied mostly on witness testimonies, mm-hmm. but looking forward, if you see any other kind of evidence that could be valuable mm-hmm. For prosecuting conflict-related yep. sexual violence.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. All right, I'll try and be quick as well. The violent nature of the crime versus the sexual component of it was absolutely one of the biggest tensions that we struggled with in writing the book. And in fact, it was one of those issues that we as an office only really saw clearly through the process of reflecting. So for us, it's a big takeaway from this process. Basically, I think it really came to a head in sentencing, because there we were confronted with how do we describe to the court the nature of the harm inflicted on the victim to describe the gravity of the crime and then ultimately the sentence that would be imposed. And we have here Laurel, who's the author of the chapter on sentencing, so she can add more later. But I think basically the way to resolve it is, I mean, there's never a disadvantage to emphasising the violent, serious nature of rape. So I think that's a given. But then there are questions around, okay, for persecution, for example, we have to choose which violation of a fundamental right to characterise rape as an underlying act of persecution. And there are choices. We could choose the right to human dignity, or we could choose the right to physical integrity. And so there, you, as a prosecutor, you start to see that the choices you make have an impact on how the crimes, or maybe we can charge it as both. Maybe that is acceptable in a given scenario. So these were some of the issues we grappled with. And with sentencing, I think it really is about, yes, by all means, describe the reality of the impact for the victim, because you're right. I mean, that's how they feel. That's the social environment that they're in. But try and do it in a way that doesn't reinforce the idea that it has to be that way, that it is in fact a diminishment of honour as a result of the crime. In terms of the evidentiary sources used to ICTY, we go into this in quite some detail in the chapter which Daniela and Priya have been co-authors along with another colleague. I think that is one of the important lessons, actually, is we tend to think these crimes have to be prosecuted based on victim witness testimony. But we do really need to broaden out our evidentiary sources and our thinking about that when we're collecting evidence. Sometimes we won't have victim witness testimony, but we may well have other eyewitness evidence that is sufficient, especially in detention settings. There were often people who saw victims being taken out on a regular basis, coming back dishevelled, that sort of thing. We were able to prove a sexual violence crime based on purely circumstantial evidence in one of our Kosovo cases, so I think that's interesting to think about as well. We also realised that
there might be a whole range of unexpected documentary sources too. For example, in our case against Ratko Mladic, who was the most senior military official in Bosnia-Herzegovina, we had his war diary. And reading through the war diary, there were indeed entries which referred to the detention and enslavement of girls in a particular region. Perhaps unexpected to think that you're looking through a military archive and you will see something so specific, but you know, in terms of his knowledge of what was going on and the fact that it was happening, it was really, really good evidence. Also, we had a procedure at ICTY where we could request material from states, even on a exploratory basis, sensitive intelligence-based material. We never really thought too much about how that might be useful in sexual violence cases. Again, I think reflecting some misconceptions and narrow attitudes to how we prove these cases. But the CIA declassified some of its records recently, and indeed there were things in there that were relevant to rape in Bosnia. Again, a compelling reminder of do not limit your evidentiary sources. There could be a whole range of things that will be relevant. And finally, just in terms of psychological abuse and torture, maybe I can just say that we have prosecuted rape as torture, recognising that often in conflict situations it is inflicted for a prohibited purpose connected to torture, whether it's punishment or to obtain information or, in fact, discrimination. And one of the lessons we distill in the book is really for prosecutors working in this field, you should really start with the assumption that rape probably qualifies as torture, given the contextual factors that we often have in our cases. And certainly not rule it out from the beginning.
Thank you. As we said a moment ago, I think there are going to be questions that will go on sort of throughout the day. But thank you for a really compelling start to the day. So if you'd like to thank Michelle again.